Welcome back, everybody, to the Drink and Learn podcast.
Yay.
I'm so excited. I am drinks historian Elizabeth Pierce.
I am bartender Abigail Gullo at Compère La Panne in New Orleans, Louisiana. And we are here at the old number 77 hotel, where my restaurant is located in New Orleans, in the warehouse district, in the beautiful studio room. Thank you so much, old number 77, for loaning us this room to record this podcast for your ears.
And for your mind.
Your mind. And for your tummies.
Well, indirectly.
Indirectly.
We are definitely coming to your ears and your mind, and then you are in charge of putting what we talk about in your tummy. I don't know if we're going to continue this metaphor.
Okay.
Moving.
Sorry about that.
Maybe we're a little giddy because we've already been drinking martinis.
It's martini time. Martini time.
Yes.
Tea many martinis?
I know there's a Christmas song. It's the 12 Drinks of Christmas, recorded by a New Orleanian. And he... clearly he keeps drinking them as he talks about them. It's where I learned about the pink squirrel. But yeah, he drinks martinis and they turn into martoonies.
Martoonies.
On the eighth day of Christmas, my true love gave to me, hey, Raymond Fizzes, seven pink squirrels, six dark Russians, five Rob Roys, four Hurricanes, three Shepherds Regals, two dry martinis, one Bloody Mary, and a partridge in a pear tree.
So I think of all the drinks that we've covered, this is the one that is the most... has the most popular culture references, mm-hmm. that shows up in all kinds of literature, mm-hmm. people drinking them, people legally or illegally.
I was at a shop today and saw some wall art of a crawfish holding a martini glass with a martini and an olive in it. I mean, crawfish are drinking them. It is very much part of our popular culture.
That's a Cajun martini. Well, so it probably has Tabasco.
A Cajun martini is a drink.
Would have Tabasco in it or some other pepper vinegar sauce, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I can't do a Cajun accent. My husband can do one.
Well, because he's actually Cajun.
Yeah.
That's helpful.
I'm better at other accents, but I can't even try. He'll just make fun of me. Mm. Okay. So here's another good quote. In fact, this is a nice little... segue, martini is just a longer word for joy. And that's from Clara Bow, who was a silent movie star.
I think when we think of the martini in popular culture, we are brought back to the age of Clara Bow and ladies drinking little martini glasses and Nick and Nora coupes with gin and vermouth in it. We think of it as very flapper-esque, very Prohibition era. But mm-hmm. the drink actually predates Prohibition.
It did. And we can talk, when we get to the Prohibition part, we can talk about how there's these ideas that liquor was bad and people doctored it up, but it wasn't always bad. And so like this idea of what the martini evolves into and becomes, you can't blame it on Prohibition. Mm-hmm. But I am getting ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. So a little down and dirty history. This man, Harry Johnson, wrote a book called Harry Johnson's Bartender's Manual, or How to Mix Drinks of the Present Style. I love when books have more than one title. It's mm-hmm. like I couldn't decide, mm-hmm. right? So the present style...
is the first golden age of mixology that we had in the middle of the 1800s.
And really... I think we kind of forget when we talk about the 19th century and we talk about all of these very, very talented bartenders that they were certainly writing the recipes down,
yes.
you know, for themselves or perhaps for whoever was working for them.
And but they were getting them published and they were traveling and becoming famous for their work.
Harry Johnson's Bartender's Manual geared to the person who is making the drink at home.
This is an emerging leisure class that is happening in industrial America.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people with the wealth and leisure to have to stay home and dabble in cocktails.
Right, which will repeat itself and repeat itself.
Again and again.
Yeah, so 50,000 copies sell, and they have a second edition. And in the 1888 edition, not only does he add illustrations, but you have detailed instructions for a drink called the martini. Although it was spelled M-A-R-T-I-N-E, which we could say martine or martini, mm-hmm. I guess. And it contained equal parts of Old Tom Gin. You should go back to the Tom Collins episode.
Mm-hmm. To learn about what Old Tom Gin is.
Yes. And called for Martini and Rossi Rosso Vermouth, so red vermouth.
That would be a red vermouth, Italian vermouth, yes.
So sweet. Two dashes of gum syrup, which is very sweet, pretty concentrated sweet. Two dashes of Boger's bitters and a dash of Curacao.
We see a lot of improvements being made to this cocktail. It's still a cocktail. It has bitters.
Mm-hmm.
It has spirit. It has sugar. It has water, but now it also has vermouth.
And
Curacao.
And the garnish, you have a choice of a cocktail cherry, a medium-sized olive. I love that the size is specified. And a squeeze of a lemon twist over the top. So the olive and lemon, it looks like if they go together, because it's olive and lemon or cherry.
That's
kind of like with the Manhattan.
Yeah.
So that's when it shows up. And by the 1890s, this drink becomes super popular, but it is called by lots of names. Sometimes it is spelled M-A-R-T-I-G-N-Y. And for folks who are fans of New Orleans, you know that we pronounce a neighborhood here the Marigny. Well, we don't say it like that. We say Marigny. But it is spelled M-A-R-I-G-N-Y, so that G-N goes together. It was also called gin and vermouth, gin and French, or gin and Italian.
Gin and French, French vermouth being a more dry style vermouth, and gin and Italian, Italian being more sweet style vermouth.
Right. So the palate or the flavor profile of an early martini could swing around a little bit for something that right now I feel like if somebody orders a martini, they would be very surprised if you made them this 1888 version.
Yeah. We also have, although it does happen accidentally when bartenders can't tell the difference between dry vermouth and blanc vermouth, and they think that blanc vermouth is dry because it's clear, but it's actually just as sweet as sweet vermouth. So people have probably been accidentally served Martinez's a lot, or that flavor profile. It does happen. It's not as common now. People think of the way it's evolved, a martini, and especially dry, as people call it, has evolved to sometimes just cold gin in a glass, which is not very interesting to me.
No.
This is much more interesting.
Yeah.
Especially if you take care of your vermouth.
Yeah, right. In the refrigerator.
In the refrigerator capped, used within 2 weeks. Thanks.
As we said in the Manhattan episode. So this name, Martini, why is it called Martini? Well, again, going back to Manhattan, the Manhattan episode. Don't go all the way back to Manhattan. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a four-hour flight.
It's very far.
For us. There was the Martini and Rossi Company who savvily, in 1906, have this huge marketing campaign. And they say you cannot make a genuine martini without Martini and Rossi Vermouth. And that is because by then they have created their own dry vermouth. So previously the dry vermouth was mostly French, and the Italian was considered the sweet or the wet. I don't know, sweet versus dry, sweet. Right? Mm-hmm. But now you can get both, and you have the emergence of the dry martini, which sounds like it's kind of getting to what people now expect, but maybe
which is just bitters and dry vermouth and gin.
And proportion wise,
I would imagine Martini and Rossi wants 50-50.
Yeah.
Which was still very popular. And it is, again, very, very popular now. A 50-50 martini, a lot of people order that. You know, when you know they take care of their vermouth and the vermouth is delicious, why have one martini when you could have two?
Or, as Dorothy Parker so aptly said,
I like a martini.
Two at the most.
Three, I'm under the table.
Four, I'm under the host. We both knew that. We didn't practice that beforehand.
There's a gin called Dorothy Parker Gin out of New York City that's absolutely delicious.
I hope that
makes a great martini.
I hope that poem is on their bottle, or at least in their marketing
it sure is.
Campaign.
Absolutely.
So then, courtesy of the martini's efforts, and also, and we can talk a little bit about this, like the why it moves to dry. But by 1906, you have the publishing of a recipe labeled the dry martini. And that's
what's
the,
that recipe?
It's two to one with French vermouth, two dashes orange bitters, one dash of Curacao.
Okay. When people order a dry martini, this is still what I want to make them. Even though I know it's not what they mean. This is a communication breakdown we're having between guests and bartenders right now. And when they say dry martini, I say yes, and I make them this. And they're like, how much vermouth did you put in there? And I'm like, it's 2 to 1, because that's what a dry martini is.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, no, I want... So now I've kind of grown accustomed to say, when they say very, very dry, bone dry, I want that martini bone dry. I say, do you want any vermouth in that at all? And they say something that was kind of popular in the 90s to say, oh, just hold up the glass and whisper vermouth into the glass.
Or what did Winston Churchill, he said, you drink your martini while staring at a bottle of vermouth.
That's not a martini, though.
No.
That's just cold gin, which is great. I even like warm gin. I'm very open to drinks like that, but that's not a martini.
Yeah.
This to me, when the second golden age of mixology started at the turn of the 21st century, I feel like this was the first public battle that we fought. And in some corners, we've won. I feel very strongly about that. A martini is gin, vermouth, and bitters.
Why do you think that people quit wanting vermouth? Because in their martini, when certainly that is not the case with the Manhattan.
No, I don't know. I don't know why they quit drinking their vermouth. Maybe they just wanted stronger drinks. Do you have a theory?
It just occurred to me, and we're getting ahead of our order because we actually do plan these things. but it's about vodka, because if you have gin, then the vermouth is so nice with that, right? They're like talking,
they play off of each other,
talking to each other.
Yeah.
But if you want a drink with vodka, then what you really want is a drink that doesn't taste like anything. And vermouth certainly has a really...
flavor to it.
Yeah, and when Abigail was mixing her martini, I noted that I am not a big fan of dry vermouth, while I adore sweet vermouth. And I certainly love
gin.
I love Madeira and I love gin, but I love things with botanicals, and I drink pretty widely and broadly, but there are certain flavors that I kind of respond to negatively. And I think that you should start doing a survey of the people who want extra dry. Do they want it with gin, or do they often want it with vodka?
I feel like they've grown accustomed to the ritual of it, and they don't really care about the flavor. Lately, I've been getting a lot of dirty gin martinis, which to me shocks me, because I'm like, if you want a dirty martini, especially filthy dirty with lots of olive juice, then that's what you want to drink, olive juice. Mm-hmm. And the vodka is just there to boost it along, and it doesn't really matter. And that's okay. Some people have deficiencies and they crave weird things. Mm-hmm. I think olive juice is that one of those things. So
you want tapenade in your glass?
Yeah, I want a little tapenade. You want some olives? The olive in a martini can be beautiful. Beautiful little bit of umami, especially when you're having that martini to start a meal. Mm. It kind of gets the juices flowing and gives that little savory bite, especially if you're having something like cheese or nuts, you know, before mm-hmm. you start, you know, cocktail hour. That umami of the olives is great. It has its place. If I'm going to have oysters, I'm going to want a twist. I'm going to want something a little bit more refreshing and light. But I want to taste those botanicals, and olive juice just masks all of that. So I've been really surprised that, you know, when people want a dirty martini, I assume they mean vodka. But I think gin is having such a popularity moment that people are, like, switching to gin. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll switch to not olive juice someday mm-hmm. and try it with gin with sweet vermouth. Because what you're looking for is that play of how they kind of play together. Cold mm-hmm. vodka and olive juice clearly plays well together.
Right.
Cold gin and vermouth clearly plays well together.
Well, so speaking of vodka.
So we don't know. Yeah, speaking of vodka, let's talk about how vodka gets introduced to a martini.
According to David Wondrich, who does lots of wonderful research on drinks history, the first vodka cocktail on record shows up in 1905, and it's a bartender who is making drinks for a visiting Russian delegation in New Hampshire. Okay, so that makes sense. Welcoming thing.
Yeah.
And then by 1911, there is a thing called the Russian cocktail, which consists of vodka and a Russian cherry cordial, which also makes sense. And this drink was on the menu at the St. Charles Hotel here in New Orleans.
Wow.
Which, Abigail, I bet if you put that, I don't know if you can get this stuff. It's called Ruinoy. R-U-I-H-I-N-O-Y.
My brother-in-law is Russian. I might be able to get this or find it.
I bet this would move here at Compère Le Pen.
What I love about this story is, like, now I'm seeing, because I have long railed against the teeny faction, the mm-hmm. chocolate teeny and the apple teeny and the peach teeny and the all the teenies. And I'm like, no, none of them are martinis. They're just cocktails in mm-hmm. glass. But now I'm seeing, well, here's perhaps the source of that is that vodka, having no flavor, starts getting other things put with it to give mm-hmm. it flavor. Just like gin already has flavor. It's flavored vodka, basically. Mm-hmm. The botanicals, the citrus, the juniper, the peels, the pepper, all the little extra herbs and stuff that you can get out of numerous gins. Now people are putting that with vodka. It doesn't have any flavor. So we want cherries. We want fruit. We want this added to it. That makes sense.
Also, for those of you that want to go find this, Ruihinoy is made from cherry stones in the same way that creme de noia is made from apricot pits.
You know what else is made from both cherries and the stones?
Hmm.
Maraschino liqueur.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about, like, using what, snout to tail?
Snout to tail. That's what we do.
More.
I love that in 1938. The Russian Tea Room has an all vodka cocktail menu. I bet that's true to this day. That's true in a lot of restaurants today. They set the standard there. I still have people that come in and look at my cocktail list and ask me if I have a martini list. I'm like, "What? Did you time travel here from 1989?"
Well, what possibly.
Now I know it's like maybe they came from 1938.
Well, when they ask that, what they mean, what do they mean?
Do I have a drink list that has drinks served in martini glasses, I guess?
Made with vodka and flavored cordial-y things.
Yes.
Okay.
That's what they mean.
Yeah.
Which for a long time throughout the 80s and 90s, that's what a cocktail list was.
Mm-hmm.
It was V-shaped martini glasses of huge proportions filled with syrups, schnapps, maybe some juice,
mm-hmm.
and lots of vodka. And flavored vodkas at that.
Mm. So now we know we can thank the St. Charles Hotel for kicking us off in 1911.
Or the Russian Tea Room.
And the Russian Tea Room. So that gets us to 1951, which is the earliest known reference to the vodka martini. But the vodka martini that most of us know of is good old James Bond.
Yes, I believe it was the 1947 novel Casino Royale, which is his debut novel under James Bond. Ian Fleming called a drink the Vesper after his girlfriend, Vesper Lynd.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in a cocktail involving both vodka and gin,
mm-hmm.
and Lillet Quina, which was a style of aromatized white wine with a little quinine in it. So close to a vermouth, not technically a vermouth, mm-hmm. But still really, really tasty. And to this day, I think that is an excellent cocktail. I've changed the proportions, but that is a great gateway cocktail to people who only drink vodka martinis. It encompasses that class and style and that habit of wanting to seem fancy by ordering mm-hmm. a drink like that James Bond would. And it uses both vodka and gin. And it uses a beautiful aromatized wine and bitters.
And for those of you that listen to the gin and tonic episode, I think that we mentioned that drink, but only in terms of its anti-malarial properties.
Yes.
And also how adorable, and by adorable, we mean totally handsome and sexy, Daniel Craig was when he ordered it. Mm.
Why do you think he shakes it and doesn't stir it?
So I have a theory, and that is because he needs to stay alert so that he can shoot the bad guy if needed. And if you shake a drink versus stirring it, wouldn't it be more diluted? So he's basically asking for a weaker drink. Oh, he's playing poker.
Yeah.
When he orders it, so he needs to stay alert.
That's an interesting theory. My theory is that he is scoping out the room and he wants to see who is easily shaken up, and if this noise of a drink suddenly being shaken draws everyone's attention to the bartender, so he could watch how everyone reacts to that and their reaction times to see who's startled and who's laser focused, perhaps maybe on their cards or on their mark, as it were.
We can't ask Ian Fleming, I don't think.
Oh.
I think he's dead, right? He's dead.
Yeah.
Well, in New Orleans, we could, because we could have a seance. I'm sure there's somebody we could find who could do a seance for us. Yeah. But the shaking thing is not even Ian Fleming, James Bond's default. Going all the way back to the 1930s, Dashiell Hammett wrote a wonderful book called The Thin Man.
Oh,
and there were many iterations of The Thin Man in movie form. That's a weird way to say that. Basically, there was the book The Thin Man, and then there were lots of Thin Man movies.
They were the most popular movies of their time when they came out.
Not based on, because Dashiell Hammett didn't write anymore. But they were like, we don't care. We got these two characters and a dog.
Great chemistry.
They did. Myrna Loy and William Powell.
And Asta the dog.
And we actually meet Nick in this scene where he is explaining how to make a drink.
This is a bartender's favorite thing, by the way, is when a guest comes up and explains to them how to make a drink. So thanks, Nick Charles.
So he's in a club, and it's a really fancy place. Oh, it's also Prohibition. You should know that. He has a shaker in his hand, and he tells the bartender.
You see, the important thing is the rhythm. You always have rhythm in your shaking. Now, in Manhattan, you shake to foxtrot time. A Bronx to two-step time. The dry martini, you always shake to waltz time.
And then soon after, his wife enters, which is Nora. She is laden with packages and is being pulled into the bar by their wonderful dog, Asta, a terrier. And she sits down and she sees Nicky, that's what she calls him, Nicky, drinking. And she asks him,
I thought so. Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis? Leo, line them right up here.
Yes, ma'am.
So that is Nick Charles' advice of how to make a martini.
That is not how I would make it, though.
How would you make it, Abigail?
Come down to the bar and I'll show you. Hi, welcome to the bar at Compare Le Pen. Now today we're going to be making a martini, the grandson of the Manhattan. So this drink is traditionally been maligned a lot, and it can be interpreted different ways. I still have people at the bar who ask me what kind of flavors martinis you have, and the flavor is gin. That's the short answer.
So I learned how to make a beautiful martini using 2-to-1 specs. Of course, it's still a cocktail, so orange bitters. However, it's been very popular right now for 50-50 martinis, since the vermouth is so nice now that we have, and also because people want to drink a little lower alcohol. But there also is a historical aspect of having a 4-to-1 martini. And in fact, built to historic design, Cocktail Kingdom came out with something called the Jigger. It is a giant, I'm holding it in my hand now, about a foot long piece of metal that has no markings on it. It looks a little prehistoric, or it looks like it belongs in a machine shop. It's super cool. And it is just the perfect proportions for a 4-to-1 martini. So one side is 0.75 ounces. The other side is 4 ounces. So we're going to try this Jigger today and make what some people call the perfect proportions for a perfect martini.
And we will take a picture of it, and Abigail and I can both put it on our Instagrams, Facebooks, whatever the way that you can find it. And then, of course, you can always go to the Cocktail Kingdom website and see it and even buy it if you're so interested.
Yeah, this was every year I like to buy a little present for my staff during Tales of the Cocktail, find them something cool or interesting, a pretty bar spoon or a really cool jigger. And this year, this was my present. I thought it was really kind of funky and weird.
It also looks like a weapon, so that could be handy post-ship.
You never know. Nobody carries cash anymore, by the way. Dumb robbers. Okay, martini, we're going to start with our mixing glass filled with ice. Once again, the martini falls under the category of cocktail, which means it has bitters in it. Traditionally, we use orange bitters. Here come 2 dashes. All right, now we're going to go with 0.75 ounces of dry vermouth. Okay, I gotta tell you, I'm having some problems using this jigger because it is so big. It is, I'm definitely not used to having it in my hand. It's gonna take a little practice. In other words, I'm glad this is a not on video and just audio. Now we're going to go with 3 ounces of gin. Ooh, that's a lot of gin. This is going to be a delicious martini. I could tell already. I think this is the kind of martini your mom would like.
You know her so well.
Again, this is a stirred cocktail. I know you guys like the ice chips on top. It feels good, and I'm happy to do that for you, especially with your dirty vodka martinis, because I don't really, that doesn't matter so much. But this is a delicate, beautiful floral gin I'm using. It has beautiful orange bitters in it. It has gorgeous dry vermouth. I want it to be velvety, smooth as it moves across your palate and down your throat. We're going to use a nice big coupe glass for this. A traditional martini glass, if you have one big enough, which a lot of people do because they're kind of made big, is perfect for this drink. Oh, that fits perfectly in my 7-ounce coupe. I'd like to enjoy this martini while I'm slurping down a dozen oysters, and I think a twist of lemon would just be perfect on top. And there we have classic 4-to-1 proportion gin martini.
It's beautiful. The coupe glass is edged in gold, so it's very fancy. And even though she stirred it and didn't shake it, I feel like Nick and Nora Charles would still approve. Okay, there's no shaking at all in this glass. And this glass, which none of you can see, but I described for you, is not a martini glass.
No, that is a classic coupe. That drink had an unusual volume. And I don't really have like big glasses like that at the bar. But the martini glass, I referenced it earlier a little bit with disdain, because in the 80s and 90s, the glass got really, really big. It got huge. It got comically large. And that was a huge volume of liquid in there. I think, you know, in order for Nora Charles to ingest 6 martinis and just have a minor hangover, I think those glasses were fairly smaller.
In fact, they were called what we now call Nick and Nora.
Yeah. Those glasses come from those films. They're my favorite glassware. I love a Nick and Nora glass. I think it's just so beautiful. I've seen it with a little straighter sides, and they're sometimes called Manhattan glasses, but the little curvy ones are Nick and Nora's.
How many ounces does a Nick and Nora hold?
Well, you have different Nick and Noras that have different sizes, but in general, it's about a 5 to 7 ounce glass.
Mm. So you didn't use the martini glass?
No. But a martini glass, it can be lovely. Some guests don't like the martini glass. They feel it spills easily. And you know what? They're right. And it looks like you're getting more. You know, it's really thin at the bottom. Like, mm-hmm. my martini glass looks bigger than my Nick and Nora glass, but they're exactly the same size. And people will sometimes be like, I want this in a martini glass because this, you shorted me on a drink. And I'll put out the martini glass and then pour the drink directly into the martini glass so they could see that it's the same amount of liquid.
Yeah.
But the martini glass has its origins from before the 1980s, I assume.
Oh, yeah, the 1920s. It mimicked that very graphic Art Deco look that was moving away from a Victorian kind of curly, fancy frou-frou. I mean, these are sweeping generalizations and trying to describe an aesthetic. But if you think about what we think of as Victorian furniture, right? Mm-hmm. Which is lots of like poofy and scrolly, and then you move into what is the origins of modern furniture, modern architecture. While some of it is organically inspired, there's a lot of like nature that shows up, but it's also a lot of geometric and graphic shapes. And that very angular martini glass, that's a new kind of glass. And it is, shows up in 1925 at the Paris Exhibition as a modernist take on the coupe. And originally, apparently, was used like a coupe for champagne.
I could see that. I have some nice small ones that are quite lovely. I was gifted them by a lovely friend when I was younger who knew I was into classic cocktails. And you could still find, like in thrift stores,
mm-hmm.
these classic. I still find a lot of glassware in thrift stores, but these are exceptional. The ones she found me are absolutely gorgeous, tiny Art Deco martini glasses that have a gold trim. They're absolutely stunning.
I also have some tiny martini glasses, but I have found that, you know, you can hardly put anything in there. It makes me think of, so one of my favorite movies ever, which is also one of my mother's favorite movies, is Auntie Mame, starring Rosalind Russell. And Auntie Mame is a magnificent bon vivant living in New York during Prohibition. And she takes in her young nephew, whose parents have died, and she teaches him a lot about life, including at age 12 or so, how to make a martini. This is like Abigail learning how to make a Manhattan. But he is preparing this martini for a banker-like stuffy person who comes over, who's supposed to be checking on his welfare.
Would you care for a martini, Mr. Babcock?
Well,
dry or extra dry?
Yeah,
but sit down, please, Mr. Babcock. I'll make them like I do for Mr. Wolcott. Never shake, bruises the gin. Would you care for an olive? Auntie Mame says olives take up too much room in such a little glass.
Why, Mr. Babcock, what an honor it is to have you in our little home. Though I wonder if it does make the best first impression on a sensitive young mind to see you drinking during business hours.
But he...
No, don't you worry. I won't breathe a word to the Knickerbocker Bank.
Now, just one minute. Where did this boy learn to mix it?
Mr. Babcock, knowledge is power.
So you talked a little bit about the olive versus the twist.
Yeah. I mean, Oliver Twist is... I mean, there's a lot of jokes that involve Charles Dickens and Oliver Twist and that, because that's a classic question that goes back. I like that it's back, and some people are like, "Ooh, lemon," and I'm like, "Oh yeah, try it." If you've never had it, I'm like a really nice martini. It's really nice and floral and lightens it up. But that umami that you get from a really nice olive is great too.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, in lesser bars, you know, I'd be like, "Oh yeah, look at the barback's hands. It's been all over those olives." Oh, sometimes they leave the olives out, and people just start helping themselves. Yes. I'm like, "No."
It's a petri dish.
Yeah. But of course, we have very, very nice. Oh, and then there's the phenomenon of stuffed olives, which my olives are really nice Sicilian olives. They still have the pits. They're juicy and meaty and so good, and they're whole olives, so I cannot stuff them. Even if I did have the cheese, which I don't.
Mm-mm.
No. There are specialty, all sorts of specialty olives that you can get and try, and they're all delicious. But I like a classic Sicilian, beautiful green olive with, like, there's in the brine, there's a hint of lemony flavor.
So then you get both.
Yeah, you get both. And there's nothing wrong with asking for both. Oliver Twist? How about both?
Bartenders. Olive and
Twist.
So the Nick Charles bit versus the Patrick Dennis, that's the Auntie Mame's nephew, I think illustrates a nice transition that we talked about with Harry Johnson's Bartender's Manual, the 50,000 copies, is that drink preparation is moving out of these very fancy, or maybe not so fancy, saloons and moves into the home. This will be solidified, particularly during Prohibition, when it's much safer to have a cocktail party
in your own home.
In your own home. Mm-hmm. And in fact, most of the drinking in The Thin Man happens in their very spacious hotel suite when Nick and Nora have lots and lots and lots of parties and lots of people over. Mm-hmm. Auntie Mame does this too. Mm-hmm. She has 13 parties in 14 days. Somebody says only 13, and the maid says the bootlegger couldn't make it on the 14th night, you know, ran out of gin.
And that's like fancy parties, but think of movies like Breakfast at Tiffany's, when a house party is also the sign of you're saving money.
Right. Exactly. And
having people over and hosting people, and you could still create a lovely experience for them. Have you seen martini pitchers?
Oh, my mother has one.
They're gorgeous. Yes. It's hard. Every once in a while I come across one in a thrift store and I'm like immediately buy it because they're so rare, because they're so delicate and tall. And sometimes they have glass stirrers too for stirring that martini. And it's just gorgeous. And if you want to make, I like to have at least one at the bar. So if I have to make like a batch of really nice martinis, I could whip out that beautiful martini pitcher.
My mother received one when she got married. It has her initials on it, her new monogram. Mm-hmm. So CTP. And I still have one of the glasses. And actually, so it's a martini pitcher, but also I think, but it came with highball glasses too. So yes. I have because it's hard to put monogram on a martini glass, but you can definitely, so I still have one of those highball glasses with CTP. She was not really, not a martini fan compared to the old fashioned, which I think we've talked about. But this idea of being prepared, the lady of the house, that she got this for her wedding to be able to make drinks for people coming over, this is an idea that is emerging as a result, I think, of this golden age of cocktails. Yes. Things start in the bar, but then they move home. And we have a quote for you that Abigail is going to read.
I love this. I love this because when I think of martinis in the home, I'm often thinking of like Mad Men and Housewives, and it's tough because it's mixed with the oppression of women, really.
Yes.
So I, and while, you know, this
martinis and patriarchy.
not always, doesn't always sit well with my stomach, which is why I prefer the martini stories of Nick and Nora, because Nick and Nora Charles are such a more equal partnership.
Yes, relatively speaking.
Relatively speaking.
But this quote, and it's a bit of a long one, but just bear with us because it's fantastic, comes from an article in the New Orleans newspaper, the Picayune, from 1900. So well before Prohibition. And I think when centuries turn, people begin to question or reassess, or where are we headed? Who do we want to be? And so this is before World War I, even before women are, you know, driving ambulances and entering the workforce in that way. But they are entering the world in this way.
Many women have taken lessons in drink mixing at their homes, wishing to surprise their husbands by their skill and also with an idea of keeping them home from the club. They take readily to the art and sometimes become quite adept in handling the shakers, glasses, and spoons. And this, you know, is the charm of proper drink mixing. It must be done deftly, gracefully, and quickly, without any appearance of bungling. For some reason or other, the modern man is rather amused with the idea of a woman attempting to mix a cocktail or make a highball, and his amusement turns to admiration when the task is performed correctly. A Scotch highball, concocted by dainty feminine hands, is far more palatable than one served over a cafe table. And at some of the afternoon teas in the early season, it was no uncommon thing to see the hostess prepare the drink for her masculine guests. Highballs seem simple enough, but they require a nicety of proportion to be good. Martini cocktails are very difficult to produce perfectly, and yet the feminine drink mixer feels that her education is incomplete unless she can make a martini, which, to a great extent, hasn't entirely replaced the old whiskey cocktail and Manhattan. While she is learning, she will spoil any amount of the necessary liquids, producing mixtures that must be thrown out as soon as tasted. Sometimes women buy one of the many guides that pretend to give instructions as to the making of cocktails, but it is quite impossible to learn the art from a book. Observation and practice are necessary, and even then many fail to acquire the knack of properly blending the ingredients.
So how are you going to observe if you aren't welcome into a bar?
Good question.
But presumably things change, particularly starting in 1920, mm-hmm. when the ladies start drinking illegally.
And how are you going to practice unless men hire you to work behind their bars?
Yeah, if you only have to practice on your husband. I guess that's the assumption.
I love that this quote still has so many truths to it. And also mentions the fact that women's dainty hands are quite good at making cocktails. Thank you.
Right. And that they caution against the buying of the book, even though Harry Johnson's Bartender's Manual, well, clearly some people were picking it up, over 50,000.
Yeah, but you so can't just the read audience. The book. You got to practice.
Yes, more than once. And figure out not only the proportions from a book, say, but then you have to find out what your husband's favorite proportions are.
And then duplicate that by a million when you actually work in a bar and deal with everybody's favorite proportions.
I feel like we've moved away from 1901 in the house, and
oh
now
God,
we're...
Oh God, it's 2018.
Now it's 2018 behind the bar. To recap quickly, not quickly, we have a drink that is very influenced by the Manhattan flavor profile. It starts out... In fact, sometimes a martini is described as a Manhattan with gin. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, that's a description. Moving into this this very dry drink, moving into a vodka-flavored, syrupy sugar thing that seems like it is now being reclaimed as this beautiful, classy, classic, simple, botanical miracle. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
It's a lovely combination. You find the right gin, the right vermouth, and the right person to make it, and you've got a beautiful cocktail.
There is a man named A.P. Herbert who wrote in the Providence News on November 6th, 1928. He wrote, "Let us have a dry martini." That is the name of the article. "Pluck me 10 berries from the juniper, and in a beaker of strong barley spirit, the kindly juices of the fruit compress. This is our alpha. Next, clap on your wings, fly south for Italy, nor come you back till in the cup you have made prisoner two little thimblefuls of that sweet syrup the Romans call martini. Pause over Paris and fill to eggshells with the French vermouth. The home incontinent and in one vessel, cage your three captives, but in nice proportions, so that no one is master, but the whole sweeter than France and not so sweet as Italy. Wring from an orange two bright tears and shake, shake a long time." Abigail would disagree with this. "Shake, shake a long time, the harmonious trinity. Then in two cups like angels' tears present them. And see, there swims an olive in the bowl, which when the draught is finished shall remain like some sad emblem of perished love. This is our Omega. Go, fellow."
Brilliant. Poetry. I love it. Ah, I love it.
You should memorize it.
I think I'm going to start doing that every time I make a proper martini.
Hmm. And if you want to memorize that quote and pull it out for, I don't know, parties or while you're mixing, you can read it and lots of other wonderful info about the martini in this book called Shaken, Not Stirred, A Celebration of the Martini by Anastasia Miller and Jared Brown, two big fans of the martini who have collected lots and lots of wonderful anecdotes and lore and facts.
And we are big fans of them. Love you guys.
Yeah. So, Abigail, we've covered all the parts. Mm-hmm. We've covered the technique and the glass. Do you have any other tips?
Here's a tip. Treat yourself to that beautiful glass that you found at a thrift store, or maybe you purchased on Cocktail Kingdom or inherited from a relative. And if you can bear it, put it in the freezer before you make a cocktail. And while you get your ingredients together, when you take out that...
How long should it be in the freezer?
Always. I like to always keep glasses in
right,
the freezer.
But so if you aren't prepared, if you aren't a Girl Scout.
If you aren't prepared and you aren't a Girl Scout, I'd say less than 5 minutes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, that won't take long. Put it in the freezer, gather your ingredients, mix your cocktail, pull your drink out of the freezer. Pull your glass out of the freezer and pour that beautifully nice chilled cocktail into a beautiful chilled cocktail glass. It makes a big difference.
Tip of the day. Good tip. Always leave room in your freezer for chilled barware. So, go make that martini.
Go make that martini. I think I'm on a martini and oysters right now.
With gin.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Thanks again to the Old Number 77 Hotel. Thanks to the National Food and Beverage Museum, whose podcast network we are a part of.
If you have questions, please send it to cheers@drinkandlearn.com.
If you make a martini or try a martini as a result of being nudged by this podcast, please, please let us know via the social medias. I'm at Drink and Learn.
I'm at Abigail Gullo.
And if you love this podcast, and we hope you do, please rate and review us on iTunes. It totally matters. And tell everyone that you know in all the ways that you can tell them.
Thanks, y'all.
Cheers.
Cheers.